tunnels are underground, where none of the children will ever be found. They wandered away to join the show and lost their way in the world below. They joined the circus and left their town. Now they live here down with the clown.
Beware, spoiler phobes! You have stumbled into A Storm of Spoilers, a podcast covering the adaptation of Stephen King's It, that is, Welcome to Derry on HBO. This podcast is split into two sections. The first section we call The Calm, and we will only cover a single piece of It media. This week, the 2019 movie It, Chapter 2. And we will not spoil anything we know about Welcome to Derry, though we will talk some about the adaptation choices that make the book different. In the second Storm section, Neil and I will break down what to expect from It, Welcome to Derry, starting next week on HBO. We're not spoiling, we're enriching. Hello, I'm Dave Gonzalez, and I've read the book by Stephen King.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I still have not read the book by Stephen King because I still do not like clowns. And welcome back to A Storm of Spoilers. Before we get started, a little bit of housekeeping, upcoming schedule time. This week, of course, we're talking It Chapter 2. That is about to happen in your earballs, so prepare yourself. Next week, we'll be back for Welcome to Derry Episode 1, which is called The Pilot. The following week, we'll be covering Episode 2 of Welcome to Derry, which is called The Thing in the Dark. Can't wait to find out what happens to the pilot and what it has to do with the dark. And then, of course, our Derry era will take us through to mid-December. Then we have some fun stuff planned for the end of the year. And then, if you haven't seen it yet, there's a Game of Thrones thing coming in January. So mark your calendars. This is the long view of what's going to be happening here on A Storm of Spoilers. And I believe pretty much all of it's going to be happening also on YouTube. YouTube.com/@Dave and Neil, DA70ANDNEIL, if you'd like to see which t-shirt Dave has on this week. I believe a gift from his mom. Great stuff. Head on over to the YouTube, like and subscribe and leave a comment and whatnot. If you'd like more, because we do more podcasts every week, you can join us over on Patreon, patreon.com/Dave and Neil, spelled the same way as the YouTube channel. Get bonus content from the many years that this feed has been in existence, but you also get new stuff like our weekly pop culture adventure. Last week we did Silence of the Lambs was our movie. We also do storm chasing. We talk video games. It's pretty great. And for folks who subscribe at the $10 level or above, we're doing a Hannibal rewatch podcast, just as we've done The Leftovers and Twin Peaks before it. And we're having a really good time. We're in like the middle of season two, and we are getting into some real sticky stuff with Hannibal. It's been pretty great. So
lots of hearts.
Yeah. So if you even remotely enjoy what you hear on this feed for free, come join us on the Patreon, which is not free, but still worth it. All right, back to this show. How do you get in touch with Storm of Spoilers? You can always email us. Send us a raven, stormofspoilers@gmail.com. That's the easiest and most efficient way. You can also review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Leave us a 5-star rating. Say whatever you want. Nobody did that this week, at least in the places that I checked, the American versions. Which is fine. We understand everybody's busy, but you know, if you got any time over the next week, drop us a little review. That helps us get the word out there. We did get a raven though, Dave. That might be a good place to start the calm. What do you think?
Let's do it.
All right. Here is a raven from LJP, sent, of course, to stormofspoilers@gmail.com. Among other things, LJP says, was interested in hearing your thoughts on the evil of Derry. I always saw Pennywise/It as a form of cancerous growth whose evil has seeped into the town and has infected every building. The people of Derry aren't consciously wanting to be evil, at least most of them are. But there's no way for that evil to not affect everyone in some way. Kind of like when you visit an old prison or a former concentration camp, that evil and misery is in the walls. Some people can mostly ignore it. Some fall prey to it and act out. i.e. Beverly's dad or Henry Bowers, and some are attuned to it and actively resist it, like the Losers Club. So even if it's not Pennywise directly controlling the townsfolk, they've been infected with his evil aura, end quote. Interesting theory, I think. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this, Dave. I'm not in love with it. This being sort of the effect of the Deadlights alien meteorite thing that we learn about in it, chapter two, because it does take away some of the agency, especially as LJP cites like Beverly's dad. I don't know, man. That I'm not letting Beverly's dad off the hook in any way. Like I'm not gonna let him blame Pennywise for being that big of a shithead. So, you know, maybe some of it, a little bit, like it's definitely giving the town like fucked vibes, I guess.
Yeah, no, I agree. But, and I think this is gonna be a great place.
Nobody's getting a lesser sentence because of this.
No, not at all. I think this is going to be a good place ultimately to enter talking about It Chapter 2, because this is a adaptation change I think that the movies make. It's not necessarily a full change, because it's more like they keep parts of the book where it is obviously influencing people in the town. In Chapter 1, for instance, when Henry Bowers is sort of beating up on Ben for the first time, that car drives by and they sort of ignore it, and then we see the red balloon go up just to let us know that it is influencing it. However, in the book, this is very much a thing. We talked last week about how Mike's story has been changed to involve like this sheep meat business, and how that sort of could have been a metaphor for why it is in Derry specifically. So in the novel, after it is defeated in the adult period, a large part of Derry actually collapses because it has been that woven into Derry physically.
Oh, so like not just the house.
Over all of these years. It's not just the house. And it does sort of affect people who are in Derry to a certain extent. It has a great amount of, I guess, like psychic influence there. So it could, you know, like turn your thoughts evil. It could give you like that little nudge. So it's not necessarily a robbing of agency as it is like, I don't know. There was a period of my life that I believed in the devil, and that was sort of a similar thing.
Okay.
Where it's like, it has the influence to push you into your worst possible self. And it does that not necessarily because, you know, it wants to, well, it is trying to take away your agency, but it's trying to make its meals sweeter with more fear.
Yeah, I imagine it's trying to create like trauma for other people, right? Like it's trying to use the adults to create trauma in the kids so that it can more easily scare the kids. Like that makes sense to me. It does, as someone who has only watched the movies, that message doesn't come across very clearly. So I imagine that is a far easier thing to understand if you've read the books, because the movies aren't selling that.
Well, and it looks like, at least from the trailers for Welcome to Derry, the way like some of these onlookers and these cops are smiling, that we're going to return a little bit more to that idea.
It'll be interesting.
Here, and they have like a character that I think is going to help along the way. Stay tuned for the storm.
Sure.
But I do want to enter in talking to chapter two.
The TV show does have more time, despite the fact that this movie that we're about to talk about is like a solid 3 hours, full on 3 hour movie.
It is a long movie.
TV show is going to get about 8. So that's more time to deal with this.
I think the thing that makes this movie such a step down from the original is I think there was a lot of smart adaptation choices in the first movie that here I feel like they weren't bound to, because with the, when the first movie came out and it was such a success and they were greenlit to do the second one, it was more like a, okay, now do the rest of the story. It wasn't trying to prove anything. They were working towards an endpoint, and they thought they had solved that endpoint, which we will definitely get to. But they filled it in with like little bits that are from the book, but similarly to the 90s miniseries and the idea that you have to split the adult and child timelines, the strength of the book comes from being able to switch back and forth between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, a lot of things are surprising and unexpected, because you're like, you were either told in the dark adult timeline that a traumatic event happened and you haven't gotten to that part in the book. So when it flashes back to the child timeline and the kids start, you know, approaching the standpipe or whatever, you're like, oh, it's about to go down. And some tension is built that way. And then it's built so also the climaxes, the two showdowns with Pennywise, basically happen simultaneously at the end of the book. So the whole ritual of Chud being lost in the sewer all sort of happens at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
This second movie is sort of robbed of any sort of actual conclusion, because I think it misunderstands the surprise that the first movie was able to give us. Here, I think by incorporating the child actors again with additional material, I'm not worried about the child actors. I'm very distracted by their digital de-aging.
Yeah.
It's especially not contributing to the movie.
Scene. I'm like, why are their faces CGI?
Or Richie running from the Paul Bunyan statue, mm-hmm. where they just use the magnification of his glasses to sort of hide the fact that they've shrunk his head. It is a little distracting.
It's but amazing. Also those, do you think Finn Wolfhard was like the youngest person who ever had to be de-aged? Because
maybe
his growth spurt hit too hard. That's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, and now he's about to be in Stranger Things season 5, and who knows chronologically right. how that lines up to the 30. Full-on adults they are now. Yeah.
Well, he's not only is he the youngest person to ever be de-aged in this movie, but he's also the youngest person to ever just power move cast his own older self, because he was like, I want Bill Hader. And they were just like, okay, all right, Finn Wolfhard, star of Stranger Things. That's great. So good for him, I guess. Power player at whatever age he was in 2019.
Well, the Muschietti's picked Jessica Chastain. Say, obviously worked with her on Mama, mm-hmm. and we're like friends. And it's not that I dislike the casting here. It's just I think the movie misunderstands what the point of this half of the story is, which is to sort of go bigger. And instead, I think it spends over half its runtime retreading something that we know the outcome is going to be,
mm-hmm.
which is Pennywise dashes at the camera, all scary, fast moving.
Sure.
So it feels a little dramatically inert, but especially at the beginning of the movie, the hate crime scene, as you point out, in the book is very much like an evidence that it has come back because it is fomenting hate in the town of Derry. It's mm-hmm. one of those things where the book makes it very clear that this is a dark influence that is causing this hate crime.
Mm-hmm.
The movie is just like, oh, we need a way to start, but without taking away that, or with taking away that sort of context that it is influencing Derry greater, it's just like, here are some everyday horrible homophobes.
Yeah.
And then whoops, instead of getting help, the clown eats him.
It's the future and this place sucks now.
Yeah.
Sucks again, I guess.
Well, and it's interesting also that I guess while we're here and have already talked about Bill Hader, the change to Richie Tozer's sexual orientation, I guess isn't really a change in the book. You know, he does seemingly like women, but he's also pointedly not married and isn't really attached to anybody mm-hmm. when he gets pulled back for the losers. So I do kind of like this change, especially because in all versions of it so far, Eddie does die in the final conflict mm-hmm. With it. And that sort of helps. But it does also feel like Stan's, you know, shower cap, where it's like something that got added in, which should have been part of the story the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in terms of, you know, like moving it around, it's actually, they do a little bit here with the Street Fighter, Henry Bowers shouting slurs at Richie in the arcade. But like that would have been a really interesting storyline in the 80s. And going back to like the first movie, Richie kind of didn't have much of his own solo flashbacks mm-hmm. that could have like preyed on that sort of fear. So bringing it up here and having the whole like, I know your secret, dirty little secret happen in like 2016, it feels like a weird time to now be bringing up his being closeted.
Sure.
When his being closeted in the 80s would have actually been like a thematically important thing to explore in the time.
Sure. Significantly less of a big deal in 2016.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And I think overall, like structurally, I think there's actually like three. If you were to smash these two movies together and cut them apart differently, there's three pretty good movies in here. They're just split into two. Because I do think that this movie gets a little distracting in its muchness, in just how much of it there is, in how mm-hmm. many times we have to come back and have Pennywise specifically terrorize each adult and then each kid and then a couple of the adults a second time as we're like along our way. I also think, you know, we mentioned the casting. The casting of the adults is really good, but it is kind of distracting in a number of ways. Because one, it's like, it's so good that I'm very impressed with it. I'm like, oh, these, you know, James Ransone matches the kid who played Eddie so perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very impressive. But on the other hand, it also puts all these characters in this weird place. And I think a lot of the other supporting characters end up in this place as well, where it's like 27 years has passed, but no one has changed at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, that really, really sort of like rings out when we meet Bev for the first time as an adult. And I'm like, okay, so she replaced abusive dad with abusive husband. I'm like, what is going on here? And it's like, what is going on with these people that none of them are any different than they were as kids? And I think part of that is that the cast is like doing impressions because of the way that they were casting and telling these stories, doing the kids first, right? Like Bill Hader comes in and he's kind of doing a Finn Wolfhard impression, which is not how you would normally do it, right? Like if you were doing this all as one project, you would cast Bill Hader first and then the kid would kind of have to act like Bill Hader.
Or they would at least,
or they would like
develop it together.
They would develop it together at the beginning. So like in this, it's like halfway through the project, you add the adults. And now we have these much better professional adult actors sort of giving us these kid performances. And I don't know. It's weird. It's a little weird because it puts them all in this weird state of arrested development that I think is sort of amplified by, like, you know, Bill as he gets back to Derry and his stutter comes back and stuff like that. It's like, I don't know, just it kind of bothered me through the whole movie. And then when Pennywise starts terrorizing them, I'm like, this all feels very repetitive.
There's a line that Richie has after they get out of the clubhouse where Mike's like, and now you need to all go on like your individual like journeys. And Richie's like, we already remember everything. And like that line doesn't take place in the book because they don't remember everything.
Mm-hmm.
The structure I was talking about before only works because they all get back to the Chinese restaurant and the conversation they have at the Chinese restaurant isn't like, oh, remember, it's like they don't remember anything.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to spend a whole time like going back in Sedari individually to find like their individual spots and remember their past.
Yeah.
This one, they all seem to like sort of remember it. And also a thing they don't hit on in the movie that Mike in the novel makes a big point of is that they all are living in their same sort of like childhood trapped fear,
mm-hmm.
but they've all become successful in the eyes of society. So like Richie's selling out that entire, you know, area.
Sure.
In the book, he's a morning talk show host, but he's like nationwide. Bill is not only a novelist, but is adapting his own novels as a screenwriter and is like married to a movie star.
Sure.
Beverly in the book is like a very successful fashion designer. And that's why, you know, she's sort of like monetarily okay, even though she's in another abusive relationship. And so the idea that like it is keeping them away because it knows if they come back, then they might like remember how to fight it again. But that it has like some sort of influence in their lives, which here they replace with Jessica Chastain has the foreknowledge of Beverly's vision that she was given in the Deadlights. So she's like, if we leave, we all die. In the book, the opposite's true. It's like, get the fuck out of here. We're like, I don't want you to come back. Because if you do, then, you know, the showdown might happen and the only people that showed me fear.
Yeah. You would think that the message, the propaganda from it would be stay away and you live nice, happy lives. Well, happy-ish.
Yeah. I mean, you can't escape your childhood, which is, again, one of the themes of the book is like whether or not you remember moment to moment what you did in your childhood. Those sort of like echoes follow you into adulthood. Mm-hmm. It's like your basic coming of age stuff. But the movie makes that secondary to another litany of scares, most of which have trouble being effective because I know everyone's going to end up being fine.
Well, it's like it's the movie just sort of makes your childhood trauma an entity in and of itself.
Right.
It has its own agency and motives and worldview. And it's a clown.
That, again, it's another weird thing that when everybody gets scared, we're spending so much more time with the clown because, as I keep explaining, it just takes the form of whatever you fear. Mm-hmm. It is very weird that the same clown that scared them, or maybe it's not. Maybe that's most thematically accurate is because they are scared of the clown from It Chapter One. But it's a weird filmmaking decision to only deviate, especially after, like, if anything, It Chapter One came under some critical fire because of its reliance on like CG characters for some of the monsters. Mm-hmm. And chapter two like doubles down with the giant old lady monster with neck mouths, which is creepy, but is sort of out of left field in terms of like it creations, and the giant Paul Bunyan that we were talking about.
Sure. Which is very like, creepy, but very, very obviously animated.
Yeah, and it's from the books and I get it, but also it's like from the childhood part of the book, so like why, if we were gonna do it, why didn't we do it back then? That's part of this movie where it feels like they're picking up the pieces, but they've just assembled them in the wrong order. Or maybe they're making this movie for people that already know what it is supposed to be, so they think like some of their changes are going to come across as like fun surprises.
Sure. And also, it does seem like, at least from watching a lot of the behind the scenes stuff, that Bill Skarsgård is sort of the centerpiece of this entire production, right? Like he talked about being very involved in the development of like the story of this movie, right? He was like in the room from the beginning with the machetes about like how this next one was going to go. So there was a very deep influence, I think, in getting more clown on screen. Like more maximizing the amount of Bill Skarsgård, because I think maybe their takeaway from the first movie was his performance is what really made it go. And that's not true. Like his performance definitely made that first movie go. So, you know, I don't blame him for going for it, especially, you know, when Warner Brothers backs up the truck full of budget and dumps it on you. And it's like, go to town on this beloved, extremely dense Stephen King property. I don't know why you wouldn't, but again, I think it's probably just like it probably needed to be two movies sort of situation.
Yeah.
They needed to make a miniseries, which they're also now doing.
I agree with your Jessica Chastain sort of, or I guess you said it to about a lot of the adult losers, but I think it's especially evident in Jessica Chastain in that she needs to be a version of Bev that never grew older, which plays less weird as the movie goes on, but at the beginning makes Jessica Chastain's performance weird to me, I think.
I think it's a tougher performance for Jessica Chastain, who I think is maybe doesn't necessarily have that gear. Like, she's a more buttoned up, mature performing actor. I don't know. It's funny because, like, in a world where everything else is equal, where Jessica Chastain is not friends with the Muschietti's, this is probably an Amy Adams role, right?
I was going to say, this is an Amy Adams thing.
Like, Hollywood eventually figures out that, like, the Sophia Lillis older version is Amy Adams. So,
right, for Sharper Objects.
Yeah, so, like...
Sharp Objects.
I definitely think that this is probably the more miscast of them, but it still works. Like, Jessica Chastain's still good. Good actress, and I think that it really works toward the end when she has to do like action stuff and be the leader of the group. So you know, I think it's sort of a mixed bag, but yeah, had Mama never existed, this is probably because you know Amy Adams also in and out of the halls of the Warner Brothers lot, so in just about every Warner Brothers movie, so seems just as likely she would have ended up playing Elder Beverly Marsh.
We talked about James Ransome a little bit, but I do really appreciate the fact that he kind of doesn't need to do anything to be
it's wild.
Eddie in this movie. It's especially obvious in the Henry Bowers stabs him in the cheek scene in like the bathroom and how he's able to sort of like move into the shower and be like, what's happening? And then eventually turn it around on him.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably like the standout James Ransone scene. And
yeah, good at getting James impaled, that James Ransone.
Doves love getting impaled. And then James McAvoy, I think, does a fine job, but sure. I do feel like of his... Of the like loser's returns, his is one of the not effective ones because his is sort of like, you know, reliving his trauma of Georgie with this skateboard kid, but it requires him to like grab a strange child on the street, shake him and yell at him about not going near the sewer drain. It's a heavy dramatic lift that James McAvoy sometimes doesn't manage to lift, I don't think.
I think that's the
whatever
thing
he's Bill's going through
is that James McAvoy has the furthest to go to get to being Bill and to like playing an older version of Jaden Martell, right? Like, he's got the accent to play, he's got to do the stutter, and I think that, you know, it's okay, it's pretty okay performance, and you know, James McAvoy is a good actor, but it doesn't come quite as naturally as some of the other ones do, or it's maybe not as easy, right? Like Jay Ryan as older Ben. Ben's a completely different person, it seems,
right,
when he's older. So he just gets to has to do the kind eyes thing, right? And just be handsome. So, but James McAvoy, a lot more to work with, and it's fine for the most part.
Yeah. Jay Ryan also gets, I think, the beginning of the short end of the stick by the totem searching, because he's just always had his wallet the entire time.
Yeah, that's true.
My memory of the movie.
That's true. Also, because they seem to pivot the story back to like Mike being the lore guy. Mm-hmm. Right? Because in the first movie, we talked about this last week, where it was like they... one of the adaptation choices they made was having Ben be obsessively about the lore instead of having Mike being obsessed about the town's lore guy. And now they've switched it back so that Mike is now the lore guy. So Ben kind of doesn't have a whole lot to do except be hot and make eyes at Beverly, which ultimately works out in the end. And, you know, I think it's fun that he's here. But again, not a whole lot to do.
And Mike, although given more to do, does not get a token moment where he has to get everything. He just shows up with a rock at the end for the ritual. There was a scene shot where he visited the burned down ruins of his family's house, which you remember is his trauma from the first movie. That was cut. And that might have some sort of influence on Welcome to Derry, that scene not being included in the official canon version. So we'll have to talk about that later going on. But also, Mike interacts with the sort of redone ritual of Chud, which is all completely different than the one in the book. So basically, everything Mike does here is kind of made up.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I don't know, man. Not the greatest.
Like, they were just trying to fit him back into the story? Because, like, what is Mike doing in the books?
He's still back, but like we talked about a lot last week, Mike's story is kind of, like, all about racism in the past.
Right.
And about finding the history of the town in the present. So Welcome to Derry is based off these interlude chapters that are based off a notebook that Mike's keeping. So we get a little bit more interior life from him because he has these journals, and a lot of the book is the build up to, am I going to call the losers at all? Like, am I able to even trust my memory even though I'm the only one to remember it?
So it's a lot of it's happening between the two movies.
A lot of it's happening between the two movies. And like, once Mike gets to be part of the group, he is a lot more, or he has to take sort of like the leadership role until Bill remembers. So that's sort of here, but they've simplified it and rejiggered it to Mike drugs Bill and we get an expository CGI drug sequence, which, like a lot of this movie, I should mention this before I keep talking about why the story sucks. I like how this movie's shot.
Sure. Hey, looks good.
Yeah.
And I think like a lot of the visual effects,
the tripping effect is
okay
crazy
as well. Like, and then there's a lot of like the lighting decisions that are really cool. Like the scene where Pennywise is about to kill
under the bleachers,
the little girl. Yeah. Which is horrifying.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of it felt fresh compared to, especially because we watched them in pretty close succession. Like, they didn't run the same plays as the first movie. It felt like a progression, which is nice.
Yeah. But that being said, the like sort of tripping scene, the reverse ritual of Chud, I don't know. This is in our new timeline updates. So our timeline updates this week are very boring because basically it all takes place in September 2016.
Mm-hmm.
That's when Adrian Mellon, the guy who dies in the beginning, dies, and Mike very quickly gets everybody back.
Played by filmmaker Xavier Dolan, who's made several very good films.
And
several
by,
filmmaker cameos in this. Also, Peter Bogdanovich, right at the beginning, just shout out.
Right, which is playing himself, which is great.
Legend.
And then while we're doing cameos, Stephen King, obviously, Bike Shop.
Yep. Also, in that Peter Bogdanovich scene, Jess Wexler, who is, in my view, a horror person in the horror canon. Have you ever seen the movie Teeth?
Yes.
Yeah, she was great in Teeth. she plays Bill's wife.
And then, so the Shokopiwa tribe, thankfully a fictional tribe, so I'm not offending anybody by dismissing this name as pronounced wrong.
If there's any offense, it's Stephen King's.
Exactly. At some point attempted the first ritual of Chud, and we don't know when that is specifically. I imagine that might also play into Welcome to Derry in terms of timelines. But also, luckily, the tribe's going to play into Welcome to Derry a little bit more.
Also, according
than they're sort of used here.
According to this movie, the meteorite that brought the Pennywise entity, the it entity, to the area has been there for millions of years.
It's what it seems like. Okay. It seems like, at least in the book.
Sure.
But I think that might also change because they
keep
it vague.
I do think that it is safe at this point to take the movies as canon for the show, right?
Right.
Okay. So, like, even if the movies are telling me something differently than what the book is saying, I should be able to match the movies to the show, but we'll see if that holds.
It might do a very interesting bit of retcon, which you have previously seen on Peacemaker Season 2.
Sure.
Which is, they might show you the meteor again,
mm-hmm.
and this time give a new date.
Okay.
So just be like, oh, hey, for the show, just want to correct you here. We didn't know we were making the show when it happened.
In 1491. I think that's a possibility.
Because the meteor has been in the trailers, so I think we might be going that far back. Okay. And if they wanted to switch the timeline around,
sure,
that could be something that happens. But here we get this idea of the Ritual of Chud. We get the idea that Mike knows it's not going to work, but he just scratches it out. He's like, no, we're more powerful than the natives as a bunch of kids who did this one time before.
Sure.
And we are, you know, sort of led eventually to our third act conclusion where this ritual goes down. Neil, so much is different about the Ritual of Chud in terms of the book. So in the book, it is described as you and the creature bite each other's tongues and then tell each other jokes and riddles, and the first one that laughs loses. That's how it's described.
So like a,
but really the book even and more the ending disturbing of the book
version of the like don't blink game, the staring game,
like a little bit. Yeah. It's a little, so the kids learn about it in the childhood timeline by creating a smokehouse, or basically like a sweat lodge, mm-hmm. in their underground clubhouse that we see in this movie.
Sure.
And Richie and Mike see visions of it, and sort of like Ben, I think it's Ben researches the Ritual of Chud and the indigenous people in the library, and it's treating it like a glamour, which is what their definition of it is children in 1958.
Mm-hmm.
But when they get down there, what they realize is it's all sort of metaphysical. So in terms of what it looks like it and one person get into a stare down. And it's Bill in the first childhood storyline. And basically what happens is it takes his consciousness and throws it out into space. And he tries to drive the consciousness out of our universe into the universe that the deadlights come from. And once Bill is there, he basically gets completely, he will get completely subsumed, destroyed, what have you.
Okay.
So Bill's consciousness is flying through space, and it's getting the sense that it's getting closer and closer to this barrier of absolute destruction, and he's panicking. Then Bill runs across the giant turtle Maturin, who created the universe when it vomited.
Cool.
And the turtle is a good guy, and the turtle's like, hey, this is like a battle of wills. You just need to kind of like stand. And so with that, Bill
just need to stand saying, your ground.
Bill saying his line that helped him stop stuttering. He thrusts his fists against the post and still insists he sees the ghosts. He starts doing that, which allows him to exert will over this ritual. And he describes the feeling of biting into its tongue. But again, this is a metaphysical feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bill's consciousness starts rushing back, pulling Pennywise's consciousness sort of back into the physical time point. And when Bill and Pennywise get back, Pennywise is like begging for its life, basically having its will dominated.
Sure.
In this metaphysical space.
Sort of like how it ends in the movie. Sort of. Just without all the space stuff.
It happens in the second time, and the second time, what makes everything more terrifying is when Bill goes out there, he realized the turtle has died between their childhood. And so like the god of the universe is dead in between the kid, the Losers Club facing off his kids and the adults. So they have even less of a backing. And it's also more difficult for them as adults because they don't have the will and the imagination of a child.
Man, I thought turtles outlived humans. That's crazy.
Well, it choked on its own vomit. So it vomited the universe up one time, mm-hmm. and it sort of created us by accident by vomiting up the universe. And then it went to vomit again, and it choked, and it died.
Damn.
I don't know what that's saying would metaphysically.
If he wouldn't have choked, would that have overwritten the universe with another vomit universe?
Or created another universe entirely?
Oh, I guess that's true. If the Deadlights universe is like parallel to ours, then there could be a third. That's crazy. Existential questions about turtle vomit.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, if you want to get into the Dark Tower series of book, Neil, there are answers to these questions. I just don't think they're going to be applicable to it necessarily.
Okay. Well, you know, keep them in your back pocket. You never know what this show is going to throw at us.
Yeah. In the book, it's very clear. There's a couple of chapters from its perspective, and it comes from what it calls outside. So it comes from like a different universe that moves through. Fun fact that actually might be part of the It universe. In between universes, there's a space that Stephen King in the Dark Tower series calls Toad Ash Space. Mm-hmm. And in that Toad Ash Space, there's like nightmare monsters. So that might also be where the Deadlights are from.
Okay.
But it's definitely in the movie and the book, The Mist. The Mist is a rip in where Toad Ash Space monsters start pouring into our universe in The Mist.
Got it.
So in the Welcome to Derry trailer, there is a mist taking over the town of Derry. I don't know if that's the mist, but if it is, it could be a rip in the Toad Ash Space that allows it to sort of like freely come out wherever it wants.
Toad Ash Space, brought to you by cocaine.
But again, exactly. But again, none of this seems to matter because in It Chapter 2, it is more important. Once we get down to the base level of the It's layer, giant It threatens them and they split up again to have another series of smaller scares when they're all split up, which at that point, I really feel the movie dragging in terms of pacing, because not only is it a retread of split scares that already happened in this movie, some of them in the case of Richie and Eddie's Three Scary Doors is actually a callback to the Chapter 1 movie.
Yeah.
And then they all get together and they insult the clown to death.
Yep. They just yell clown at him. I will say this, though, of the individual scares, the one that happens with Ben and Beverly, where she's in the stall and he's like,
and he's in the hole, the hideout,
is the way it ends is visually very cool. So like some of these gags, you can see it just being worth having in there because it just looks awesome. But this isn't a clip show. It's supposed to be a coherent end-to-end movie.
Right.
So that's where it kind of stumbles up, all over itself. But, I, you know, there's several moments here, especially at the end, like that scene, the scene right after that where Bill gets, or Bill Hader's character, adult Richie gets hit with the Deadlights is just like insanely cool, even though much of that sequence is so dark. That it's, you know, I mean, it's obviously it's hiding a lot of like Pennywise spider nonsense, but, you know, there's stuff that I like
in the secondary Deadlights, the blue Deadlights, which are, I don't know what the point of those are, but yes.
But yes, there's some cool stuff in here. But by this point in the movie, I was just like check-in time. Like this thing is how are there still like 50 minutes left in this movie?
Yeah, it's amazing to me because I do like the shrinking effect of Pennywise. I just don't like that we spend so much time on the ritual as a distraction when the ritual was always a metaphor for what they did so well in the first movie, which is just if these kids have the belief to defeat it, they can. It's a feelings battle, and the movie tries to simplify that to like make him feel small and like all things must, you know, obey the rules of the body they inhabit, and like that means if it's a clown you can insult it. Our surface level connections that I feel like if this movie was threading those ideas all the way through 2 hours and 50 minutes, 2 hours and 50 minutes is enough time to solidify the idea of like a metaphysical belief thing is happening. Something's happening beyond the rules that Mike can just tell us, which is something the book does well, is it's like they all get feelings or like they just know something because they're at the center of this metaphysical battle where, as our listener wrote in, there's like psychic things at play that they don't even really know about until they become the tool that needs to take Pennywise down. Just doesn't look great with the insulting. I do like Shrunken Pennywise, and I do like them pulling its heart out because that is semi-book accurate.
And I really enjoy the all of the different filmmaking tricks that had to go into making that effect. Like there was like a body double that's like a kid actor wearing just like a face mask. And then they had like a fake body and they put Bill Skarsgård like in the wall so that it's just his face with a fake body. A lot of cool, very, very tricky, practical effects went into to making that all work. And I think it's very cool. And again, Bill Skarsgård is giving sort of the centerpiece performance of this entire two movie cinematic journey. So, you know, the fact that he delivers, I think, still makes the movie worth watching. And I think explains why it was still very successful, despite not being loved by critics, still almost made $500 million at the box office because, you know, people were into the way Pennywise worked at the very least.
It made so much more so much more money than your everyday Tron Ares that they're like, let's make a HBO series about it.
Yeah, they can't wait to take that profit machine to streaming.
And then saved for last, because this is where they sort of, I think, really do dirty by the character. At the end of the movie, we get a Stan Uris suicide note that makes everybody supposedly feel better about the fact that Stan wasn't there.
I'm told this is an adaptation choice.
It is.
Which is interesting because I'm not a fan of this. Because this is...
No,
this
what did you make of it as somebody who hasn't read the book?
Well, this is the movie painting Stan's suicide as him going out in a heroic fashion, right? Him being like, I did this for you guys. Which is not a great message to send, friends. You know?
Well, also like...
To the world.
Do tell them that... Don't post-date a letter till after it's going to be all over and send it to their not dairy homes. Like, they could have used this information pre-Chinese restaurants.
Well, because, okay, so as far as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, in the books, Stan is just very scared. And that's why he kills himself. Which...
He can't do it.
He just can't do it.
And it's also like it's in like the first part of the book. This is that's the first phone call Mike makes. And it's the first one where just like Stan can't take it.
Yeah.
And it creates this terror in us because we're like, what can he take? But here it's like, oh yeah, we're doing the adult storyline now and Stan can't be here. So, nah.
Well, and it's interesting because the way this movie starts, that's how it reads, is that Stan gets the phone call. Whatever it is, he can't take it, so he does what he does. And it's like, I don't understand the reason why you would come back around and try to make this into like Stan did the right thing, because it's awful. And it also still has the same motivating effect that it would have if Stan did it for the right reasons, quote unquote. So like, what is the point of coming back with this letter at the end? It's a very weird adaptation choice. And I don't like it because I think that, like, you know, obviously it's just a movie and so it's fake, but it's a weird message for a movie to send, especially when you kind of don't need to comment further on why Stan did what he did. Cause it's kind of obvious.
2 hours and 50 minutes in, I'm not even thinking about Stan anymore. Yeah. Like it doesn't need to come up at all.
Right. Like they burned the shower cap. Stan was there. It's fine. Right. Like
they gave him,
Losers Club member died since then. So like we've moved on. Unfortunately,
they did shoot a Stan, bar mitzvah scene for chapter one that got deleted. Mm-hmm. And here they sort of like bring it back to reinforce that Stan is some sort of like motivating factor. And the only thing that was kept is they're like, oh, we have Finn Wolfhard's reactions mm-hmm. from It chapter one. So that's the one scene where Finn Wolfhard's not de-aged because they had that left over from a deleted scene. But everything else they had to bring around, which is odd because there are sometimes this movie does flashback scenes that it did reshoot and it changes weird things for like nonsensical reasons. I don't know. This movie is indulgent in the wrong way, I sure. think would be
that's a good way to
my overall
it,
take
yeah.
on it.
Yeah. And listen, indulgent isn't always a bad thing, but this feels like playing with your food a little bit too much.
Yeah.
As a filmmaker.
Speaking of, you called out a cameo from Miss Octo who comes out of the fortune cookie.
Yeah. Shout out to Miss Octo, who I did not expect to see in this movie, but you know, keeps getting work. It was getting work back in the day too.
Yeah, the giant the eyeball with tentacles is in the book a giant eyeball with tentacles that they fight in the sewers.
That's fun.
They're like going down the dark sewers and they hear a weird sound and they light a match and it's just fucking an eyeball with tentacles moving towards them. It is terrifying. So that one's like sort of a nod to what's in the book. The fly with the baby head, that's one of the Muschietti's
sure
weird
I do
predilections.
You do kind of wonder how influenced Noah Hawley is. I mean, you almost kind of assume that he's a Stephen King guy. He's a big nerd. So like maybe there is some light linkage between the book and eventually having a Miss Octo in Alien Earth. That's kind of fun. It's kind of fun to think about.
Well, yeah, it was an eye that they fought, I think, when they were kids down in the sewer, and it was because Richie was terrified of the giant all-seeing eye. But it was something that he had read about in like a comic book. Mm. Like again, the book makes the fear of the children sort of pop culture related. Or in this movie, in the book, when Beverly goes sees Mrs. Kirsch, it doesn't turn into the neck-mouthed monster. She turns into the witch from Hansel and Gretel, and the apartment turns into candy. Sort of this idea that it is like making them afraid of luring them back.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, in the book, it makes a lot more sense that it is splitting them up and scaring them because it doesn't want them
sure
to be together at all.
And also that
it wants them to leave.
It's exploiting trauma that's familiar to them, right? So like
right.
she's already aware of that scary story about Hansel and Gretel. So of course he would use that, you know?
Yeah. So it becomes the witch and then it becomes her dad because again, the book is very much more about like, it becomes the thing that you fear and uses that symbolism a little bit more, which I hope have high hopes for the series, which we'll talk about in a little bit in the storm. What else to even talk about this movie? Henry Bowers is back.
Yeah. I totally forgot, even though I'd seen these movies before, that Henry Bowers comes back. Hilarious. The thing I really forgot about was that the Hostetler guy comes back as a zombie.
Yeah.
Not only to deliver Henry his knife, but to then become his Trans Am chauffeur for the rest of the movie.
Yep.
Which is genuine comic relief because it is the silliest shit in this movie. Even sillier than anything Pennywise does. And I'm like, is this from the books or is this the movie just riffing?
So it is from the books. It's a different character, but because in It Chapter One, they cut out Henry killing his friends. So if you remember in It Chapter One, he gets the switchblade in the mail.
Yeah.
He kills his dad. He's picked up in the blue Trans Am by two of his friends. Mm-hmm. And then he shows up at the Kneebolt house covered in blood. It's because he killed his two friends, which was a scene they cut out
okay.
of the first movie. And so it's supposed to be one of those friends, Belch, the guy who burps.
Mm-hmm.
It was supposed to be Belch. It's Belch in the books, but it is a zombie. One of Henry Bowers' zombie friends shows up and drives his car. That absolutely happens in the books.
Amazing.
But you also don't notice it because you only are through Henry Bowers' perspective. So, like, he could be driving himself in a not Trans Am. We don't know. Mm-hmm. That's, again, the power of the book, that we only see what Henry's seeing, and it makes sense to him because he's crazy. And so the book's very nonchalant about it, where he's just like, he looked a little worse for wear. Like, I last saw him in the sewers of Derry, but he can still drive, you know, like.
Yeah. I mean, genuinely just wild that Henry survives. But, you know, it's fun. I also got this one thing from the DVD behind the scenes. I wanted to run it by you here, Dave. Bill Skarsgård, in one of the interviews, is talking about the ending of the movie. And he kind of argues that this is what Pennywise wanted. That he ultimately, so we talked last week about what Pennywise says at the end when he says fear, what he meant. Mm-hmm. And the way Bill Skarsgård seems to interpret it is that when he says fear, that is Pennywise experiencing fear for the first time. And because these losers are the ones that made him experience fear for the first time, that he kind of wants to go out this way. Like, he wants to be defeated. If he's going to be defeated, I guess he wants it to be them. So I think, at least in Bill Skarsgård's mind, Pennywise ultimately wins here. I guess maybe you could see a scenario in which Pennywise wants one of two things to play out. Either he wants to keep them away completely, but if they are going to come back, it might as well be them who gets them, which is why he's so ultimately resigned at the end. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But, you know, Bill Skarsgård playing the character. He wants Pennywise to get a W on the way out.
That's a reading that explains a lot, because, again, in this movie, there's no reason for Pennywise to encourage them to come have a showdown with him.
He could just keep taking random kids.
Yeah, he's going to feed well for the most part. But, you know, it starts with Mike finding that, like, comeback written on the bridge in blood. So it's like taunting them all back to maybe get defeated. I could see that's how he was playing Pennywise. I just think it's a weird read on the character that is very specifically about his portrayal.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, interpreting how he was doing fear leads his portrayal into this. In the movie, both times Pennywise is either weakened or whatnot, he's begging for his life. In the second time, when he's facing the adult losers, he's like, I could give you a really long life. I can't give you infinite life, but you guys could live like 200 years if you just let me go now. Like, I'll give that gift to you. And it's bargaining for, like, everything, because it doesn't want to, you know, die. It just, the problem it has with the adult losers is before it made it feel fear, and in that time period where it sort of like recovered from the damage that the losers did to it, it now suddenly has the concept that maybe it could die, which is a new concept for it. So I would say maybe if Bill Skarsgård's playing it like it's curious about what happens, like, can...
Sure.
That reads a little bit more straight sociopath to me. It's like, well, why wouldn't I do this? They probably can't do anything to me, but it's the most interesting thing that's going to happen besides, like, the rampant homophobia that I usually feed on.
Because it sounds like previous to this, the town didn't put up much of a fight, but I guess that's what we're going to find out in the miniseries.
That is what we're going to find out in the miniseries. So before we do start talking about Welcome to Derry, is there anything that you feel like we need to cover about It Chapter 2? We've only talked for a third of its runtime about It Chapter 2. So is there anything we didn't cover?
Shout out to the actor who plays Mike Hanlon, Isaiah Mustafa, being the Old Spice guy. Just in case you watch this movie and you're like, that guy looks familiar, but I can't quite place it. He was the dude from the Old Spice commercials. But he also, I would say, in watching some of the behind the scenes about the cast, he is maybe the one who... did the best job of sort of matching the kid and kind of having to match the kid. Like, you know, James McAvoy's performance is a little shakier at times. Jessica Chastain doesn't seem to be trying to match Sophia Lillis quite as naturally. And then, like, you have some real easy ones like James Ransone and Bill Hader. but and Jay Ryan, as we discussed, doesn't have to. But Isaiah Mustafa, like, he kind of gets the mannerisms of the kid really well. So, you know, he's so much more than the Old Spice. Was he a Minotaur? I can't remember what the Old Spice commercials were.
He was lots of stuff, I think.
He was a bunch of different things on those commercials.
He was holding pearls, then he was holding diamonds. Look now. Yeah, I actually wouldn't mind if he wanted to come back and do some Welcome to Derry stuff. It is going to very much focus on his family.
Maybe
so
some voiceover?
If somebody was good, maybe some voiceover. The one of the big differences that the It Chapter 2 makes an adaptation also at the end is in the book, they all forget again.
Mm-hmm.
Like once they leave Derry, that magic is broken and they all kind of forget they did either of the battles against it, which I always took as like the world kind of healing. Like, you know, let's say the world is part of this vast multiverse and there are forces battling that sort of use us as tools. You know, if we like beat something back, if you made children or adults for that matter face an eldritch terror, isn't it on the side of your continuing sanity to forget about it?
Sure.
But here, they all remember.
Yeah.
So that means that maybe we get more Mike in Welcome to Derry. It depends how many time periods we're covering. The answers to that and more as we move into the storm.
What are you doing in the sewer?
Oh, storm blew me away. Blew the whole circus away.
All right, Neil, we're back for the storm. I've sort of squeezed. Last week, we did just about the Red Band trailer. Mm-hmm. And I got some cool information from that moment. But I was like, you know what? The It fandom is large and wide. We must know some more things about It.
Sure.
They were at Comic-Con panels. They've been doing promo. They want me to watch It. So maybe there's more out there that I should know about Welcome to Derry if I'm purporting to do a podcast where I have some level of expertise on it. So here's the things that I think we should be looking forward to.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you the ones that I am absolutely sure about, and then some of the things that we might speculate together on what might happen. So here's, I think, the important things to think about for the whole series. It is 8 episodes. Final one will air December 14th. So we're going through November into December. Mm-hmm. Andy Muschietti at New York Comic Con mentioned that the season is told in reverse. So I think we are dealing with 3 appearances of It in 27-year cycles. The 1962 one, which we've seen a lot of. The 1935 one, which I think there are some hints. We talked about in the Red Band trailer that page boy running from like a decrepit person through the forest. Mm-hmm. That might be it. In some of the trailers, there are like people holding guns gathering outside of the library. I think that might be sort of like a gangster shooting that in the book takes place in 1935. Mm-hmm. And then there's a incident in the past of the town of Derry where a man sort of lost it and went on an axe murdering spree in a bar. And the other patrons sort of just sat around and kept eating like nothing was happening as he sort of went around and started chopping people up. Very terrifying scene in the book. And in terms of It Chapter 2, I believe that is why that axe is in a display case in the library, mm-hmm. is because they're alluding to that happening. So I think that axe is ultimately the axe that gets embedded in Henry Bowers. That's something we could see maybe in 1935.
Okay.
And then 1908 is the other period that we know about. That was the Iron Works explosion that left the kid's head in a tree that we learned about from Ben in It Chapter 1.
Okay.
So I think those are the time periods, and I think they're going backwards. The 1908 one, we might even be going back further, because Andy Muschietti also talked about hiding the clown in an interview with Collider that came out this past week, which basically means It is not necessarily going to take the Bill Skarsgård Pennywise form immediately.
Okay.
I think I mean, it might be several episodes.
We have seen different versions of the clown in the trailers, right? We saw the Uncle Sam version in the Red Band.
And we see like a woman smiling through a shop window that looks pretty terrifying. We see a policeman smiling also through a window. It looks pretty terrifying. So I think it might be building to the reveal as a clown in a little bit, because at New York Comic Con, the Muschietti's also said that part of this series and part of the reason why Bill Skarsgård was motivated to come back, even though he wasn't initially mentioned as part of this series, was figuring out why it chose Bob Gray, the guy who became Pennywise, as its favorite form. Mm-hmm. So we're probably going to go back at least through flashback or maybe through like some sort of more metaphysical
dream scene. Which does, in a meta sense, feel like a good companion to the movies, because then it's like, all right, now we're going to explain to you why it's important that we showed you so much of this damn clown in those two movies.
Which is fun, because if we're building to the clown, if we're hiding the clown, if we're showing that it eventually chooses Pennywise, but maybe only comes out when it's like super potent, we get to save a lot of the stuff from the book that we were talking about, the town being evil, them sort of being this funk around it. And then, we might have a way to sort of get into that, because we do have Dick Halloran, played by actor Chris Chalk. He is at the military base with one of the Hanlins. He's going to be a character. And he, of course, has The Shining. And so if you watch trailers and from some of the scenes that have been showed at the various cons, it looks like Dick Halloran's going to figure out that it is here first. We see pictures of him down by the pile of floating children. We see pictures of him by the Pennywise, the Dancing Clown's box that Bev saw in Chapter 1. And then we've seen sort of scenes and pictures of him looking out in the distance as like a ghostly presence that might be his mother, who also had The Shining, sort of luring Dick away. So if I had to guess, Dick Halloran realizes something's wrong with Derry. He's at a period of time in his Stephen King biography where he's sort of trying to tamp down The Shining. He thinks it's like a little weird, but he might be drawn and have a showdown with the Deadlights or with whatever it is. And he might be the one that is able to give us a wider perspective on what's actually happening, because he's tapped into this supernatural area.
Sure.
So I hope.
And he also might be the solution to the, how does anyone on this show get a win if in the end Pennywise can't lose problem?
Correct.
The corner that this show has already written itself into just by existing, right? Because like, we know that Pennywise doesn't even start to feel fear until the losers come along in the 80s. So Pennywise can't take any L's in this series in the way that we would traditionally expect. So I guess having him come up against somebody with The Shining would be a different kind of way for Pennywise to lose.
And an opportunity to see Martin the Turtle. Just saying. We're going to have a metaphysical turtle.
Watch, I love it.
I think it'd be great. Fans would love it. They put a lot of turtle stuff, even in Chapter 2, when Ben's going back to the school, we see a turtle on the desk. So they know we want the turtle. Maybe this series gets weird enough to do the turtle.
It's turtle time.
I think we're definitely starting in 1962. We know our characters, our African-American leads, will be the Hanlon family. So the main character, Leroy, is Mike's grandpa. We saw him in the 2017 movie. And then Will, Mike's father, is one of the main kids from the 1962 timeline. And then the actress Taylor Page plays Charlotte. That's Mike's grandmother.
Sure. Oh, and Mike's grandpa being played by Jovan Adepo, who is Michael from The Leftovers.
Yes. Oh, yeah, you're right.
Still getting those HBO checks. Good for him.
All that's going to be great. We know Mike's dad burns to death because of It Chapter 1. Because It Chapter 2 took out the fact they burned to death in a house. maybe this can be posited as something different.
Sure.
I'm looking for not necessarily a win like they beat Pennywise. I'm looking for a perspective win.
Well, he has to make it to adulthood in order for Mike to exist.
Right. He has to make it to adulthood in order. He has to make it to adulthood in order for Mike to exist, but also the It Chapter One storyline is sort of like Mike's parents were drug addicts and they burned to death inside of their house. Right.
And it rewrites it at the end.
The drug addict stuff is not part of the book.
Sure.
So it would be interesting if that's a different perspective. But or
the movie also makes that seem at the end like it was like a glamour. Because he sees a different headline at the end, right? Like that's not related to drugs. So it makes it seem like Pennywise was like putting that memory in his head. Maybe that wasn't what
and I would
happened.
Like that to be somewhat reinforced or echoed with just the idea that I would like some tinier wins in the story that we already know if we aren't allowed to have the big win of Pennywise. Mm-hmm. So the Hanlons moved to Derry to work at the nearest military base. This does exist in the book. It's called the Old Derry Army Air Corps because in the book, the Air Corps would turn into the Air Force in 1941. In the book, the flashbacks are obviously pre-1958, mm-hmm. so much more in that time period. And then in the 60s, we have our losers, which had Lily is our lead, played by Clara Stack. I think she's going to be the character we're rooting for, and then ultimately the character I'm most scared about if we don't get to win in this series. Mm-hmm. We have Ronnie, who is our black girl. We have Rich. He's the one you saw us throwing a toy plane. He appears to be Latino somewhat.
Sure.
We see a little bit more of him sort of making friends with Will in one of the earlier trailers. And they, I think, are going to make up our main group. There are some more characters. There's Mikey, who we see occasionally, and then there are Teddy and Phil. Teddy is interesting because it's Theodore Uris, so it's Stan Uris's somewhat relative.
Okay. Maybe like an uncle or something.
Yeah. And then there's Phil, who's only interesting because both the actors that are played as Teddy, or the actors listed as Teddy and Phil, at least in the current credits that we have for the show, are not mains. They're recurring. So
we know how that goes.
That looks weird. Also, in the first trailer, right in the middle of a crossfade, you can see a missing poster for Teddy Uris. So I think eventually we're going to see some kids in 1962 go down. Sure. But there is some hope in 1962. There is Rose. She is the owner of the shop, the Secondhand Rose. She is an indigenous person and is a descendant of the first Losers Club. So we are going to go back. We're going to see an indigenous Losers Club made up of indigenous kids.
Cool. Finally, they at least get to appear to tell their own story instead of having Mike tell us.
Yes. I don't know if that first Losers Club is the one that tries the ritual of Chud and it doesn't work out, or if there's another one. Mm-hmm. But Rose is surviving, at least come 1962, her third cycle. So she was alive for 1908, she was alive for 1935, she was alive for this one. So she's going to be, as is probably fitting, our ancestral memory of when these other things happen.
Which is interesting, and I think goes to one of my biggest questions going into this series, which is, like, how is it possible? Because, like, I get the concept that when they leave Derry, they forget. But how is it possible that this town doesn't pass down more, I guess, institutional or communal knowledge about the clown and the entity from, like, generation to generation? And, like, is it just that, like, everyone who encounters him dies? Is it part of, like, the magic that he has, that he can erase that? Is it just the indigenous people? Are we going to find that out, that they're the only ones that can remember because they're better at passing down stories or something? that would kind of make sense to me, but like there is something weird about the fact that, and I, this is something the show is absolutely going to have to answer if it's going to tell me three different, you know, because like I get it in the losers timeline, they're the only ones who seem to know, but it's like, how didn't anybody figure this out beforehand? You know, if Ben and Mike can kind of figure it out as kids.
Right. Yeah, I will. It will be interesting to see, because it does look like with our 1962 losers, they will be sort of on that same trajectory of trying to figure out what's going on. They will figure out what's going on and they will have some sort of showdown with it. I think that's a pretty easy prediction. But yeah, in terms of who has that knowledge, that's a good question. I think it's a slippery slope, but it's a very interesting and important one that at least part of this, according to the trailers, is going to deal with the Derry police, mm-hmm. which is left out entirely of the first two movies. But in the book, the sort of hate crime is toiled through an entire police investigation into including like questionings of the suspects. There's a lot about the town instituting a curfew, and there's a lot of discussion amongst the kids about like, why are the parents not super worried about the fact that there's a bunch of missing kids? Mm-hmm. And so I would hope that if we are going to fully explain this, we're going to figure out why Derry doesn't make a big deal out of this. My guess would be the indigenous ones are the ones who see it clearly because they have some sort of knowledge they've been passing down, and that all of the white people will just put it off on a societal ill. Mm-hmm. When the black spot eventually burns down, they'll be like, well, that's what happens with the KKK. They won't be like, that was it.
Sure. I guess the one that makes me most curious is Mike's dad.
Yeah.
Because it's like, all right, Mike's dad lives to adulthood, survives whatever happens in 1962, kind of has to, canonically, biologically, in order for Mike to be created. And how did he never mention this? Like, he just never got around to it before he died in a fire? Like, that's a question. So, like, I actually do kind of... fair or unfair, I'm putting that on this show to explain to me by the end of it, how did this character Will survive this ordeal and then make it to adulthood to have a child, but why would he never tell his child about this?
I mean, fair enough. Mike's grandpa's full on in the first It chapter one.
Yeah.
He's still living in Derry.
Same question for
what
him.
What the fuck there?
What's going on? Like, you know, and who knows, maybe the season finale of Welcome to Derry ends with Mike's grandpa and his dad having a conversation about how they can never tell anyone any of this shit. But yeah, you know, I do kind of expect an answer on this.
So that's going to be interesting. Let's talk a little bit about what I think we're going to be doing next week.
Okay.
Which is, I think we kick off, we're definitely going to get the Hanlon story established, but I think we're going to, based on some stuff that has been showed at cons, we're going to deal with this kid, Mikey, who has a pacifier as sort of like a comfort device. I think he sneaks out to go see movies at the theater. The movie theater seems to be playing a much bigger part, like it does in the book in this adaptation, because mm-hmm. we saw last week in the Red Band trailer somebody face off against a zombie. I think it was Ronnie, but we'll see how that turns out. Is trying to get home after the movie because he stays too late or had snuck out to begin with. Hitchhikes home and gets picked up by a family that is all it, 100% it family. Mm-hmm. The mother will be pregnant, and just letting people know is an advisory if you're really weirded out by this stuff. I think the baby is also it, and I think the baby gets its way out of there somehow.
Clown baby. Great.
So while they're scaring this kid to death inside of the car, the kid disappears. And I believe that is Mikey. And Mikey will have been friends with our losers. And I think Mikey's disappearance is what kicks off things really for our losers.
Okay. So he's the
I believe that's what we're looking. Yeah, he's the Georgie in this one. I don't know how many other side characters we're going to set up. There is a scene in the first trailer of Rich meeting Will. And while he's doing that, Rich is sort of looking at some popular girls walk down the hall, and he's sort of admiring them. And Mike notices those are also the girls we see getting caught in the deadlights later in the trailer. And then we see a whole bunch of missing posters, including their names, in trailer 2. So this is such a mass event.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the missing posters might be like a vision a la what happened to Finn Wolfhard in chapter 1. But Andy Muschietti in the New York Comic Con also said that the black spot burning down is the centerpiece sequence of this season. They thought about shooting it on the volume, but they were like, no, let's just like put it together through like various set pieces. So it took them a while to shoot the black spot. In the book, the black spot is a club for African-American service members that ends up having a really good band. So it gathers the ire of the white service members that the black club would maybe have something better than them. Mm-hmm. So it gets the attention of the Legion of Decency, which would eventually become the KKK, and they block all the doors and burn it down. I know that we're dealing with racism in Welcome to Derry because they're definitely forefronting that with the Hanlons, but I've seen like a big burning building with the clown in front of it. The only thing I've seen of people seemingly being locked in anywhere is it does look like all of these kids are locked into a dance, and that dance might be where they see the deadlights. So I'm beginning to wonder if maybe we've changed the black spot from a club for African-American service members into a club for teens. Here in the trailer, we see the popular girls. And then we see the popular girls all getting deadlighted. And we see Pennywise in front of a burning building. But in the Red Band trailer, there is a blink and you'll miss it moment where it's a bunch of these kids slamming against the door as if the door has been locked from the outside. So I'm wondering if this series is going to turn the black spot from a club for African-American service members to a club for teens.
Interesting. I mean, it's either that or they're going to do the locking someone inside somewhere gag twice. Like the kids get locked inside also the movie possible. Theater or something.
So usually what happens with it is it like wakes up or goes to sleep with a giant mass casualty event. So I do think the black spot's going to be what we're building towards. Mm-hmm. So I guess that depends on how many missing children Derry can put up with in this 1962 period.
Well, and do you think when Andy Muschietti says that it's being told in reverse, he just means reverse chronological order of the big events, or do you think it's possible that we see the black spot happen
soon
in the first couple episodes and like, I mean, work that, back from there somehow?
That is the question. It's sort of like, how is the season structured? Are we going to have like mini conclusions? Like by episode 4, are we done with 1962? You know, like, is that something that's going to be possible? In terms of like the footage in the trailers, I would say like whatever's happening with like the mist and the kids in the mist, that seems to be a large set piece that isn't the stuff burning down, but we have all our losers in there sort of doing a showdown with Pennywise. Mm-hmm. We have some scenes of Lily sort of like looking at pictures of old Bob Gray. So maybe they're like bookends within bookends, whereas the kids are learning about it, we get to actually see some of it.
Mm-hmm.
They did shoot a scene for It Chapter 2 that ended up being cut. They said because it was too disturbing. I think just because it doesn't fit in the story. But with a pre-Pennywise the Clown version of It bargaining with what they called a Victorian era woman, but basically like being like, all of you, the entire town could live if you just give me your baby. And she does in like a Rumpelstiltskin, like, you know, folktale kind of way. But then it just devours the baby. Mm-hmm. And they were like, it was too intense of a scene for part two because it like ate a baby. But we could see something like that just in a different era. This sort of like pre-Pennywise it hunting.
Okay.
I would say only Rose from Secondhand Rose knows that stuff. But we do have a bunch of research being done by Lily and some of the other losers on microfiche. So maybe they also get to figure out in terms of that. But I would say we're mostly going to, I would, each episode we're going to have like, maybe, and this is a way to look out for us while we're watching.
Sure.
Each episode is going to have a handful of characters whose fear is being exploited by it. And then I assume there's going to be like a showdown of people with that fear, because the adult stars, when they were on their New York Comic Con panel, were all talking about what their characters would fear if they had like a showdown with it. So I think we're going to see it exercising itself as different versions of fear that eventually build to the clown. I feel like that's
okay.
What it's going to be. There's a bunch of shots of the clown version of Pennywise in the trailers in like a black and white world, where the only things that aren't black and white are the yellow of the eyes and the red of a balloon.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what type of sequence that is. Dream period. Otherwise, sure. If we're going to get like
something that, you know, was very simple to shoot and easily accomplished in the 2 or 3 days they had Bill Skarsgård on set.
Right. But I'm excited to see these other versions of it. In chapter two, we get to see briefly in the flashback of what happened to the original Ritual of Chud people, that it appeared to them as a bird. That is one of its sort of more famous old timey appearances before it was clown all the time, was it used to be sort of like a giant big bird. I imagine some sort of allusion to like an evil thunderbird in terms of native tribes, but since it's not just Stephen King, I imagine the series will be able to treat that a little bit better if it wants. What I'm looking for here is I want more of the prejudice that is in the book. So in the book, we, from the Urus family, we get a bunch about what it was like growing up with the anti-Semitism in the 20th century. With the book, we get a bunch of like what it was like growing up black in the 20th century. The movie kind of avoided all of that. It seems like they have characters here with Theodore Urus and the Hanlins that are going to be able to address those things. Mm-hmm. And with the indigenous characters, even though you could let up on the indigenous characters, I think just because they're in it doesn't mean they have to be victims of it all the time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see if that happens. And I like this idea that goes all the way back to our first Raven of the episode, which is like the town is it. I would like to build towards a metaphysical understanding. I think the payoff to the series could not necessarily be Pennywise winning, but the widening of the It universe to finally encompass everything the book did, which is just there's a haunted town and this entire town's haunted and it haunts the people in it. And it's all about this metaphysical battle between a being of light and a god that is using a turtle avatar. I think that would be an interesting metaphysical build.
All right. So we're on Turtle Watch. We're on Baby Devouring Watch.
We're on Fear, just General Fear Watch.
General Fear Watch. We're looking for a series that is more evolved. Some would say woke, but I think of it as evolved, that has a more modern sensibility, but retains the honesty of what Stephen King was at least going for in the books. And then I'm looking for one that answers some questions about why no one in 1980s is talking about any of this nonsense. So I'm into it. I like the lore. Like, I think the lore is fun. So this is more interesting to me, especially if, even if it's due to budget limitations, there's less clown in this.
That's what I was going to go out on, is knowing I was hanging out with our mutual friend Julian last weekend. He was like, I was watching your It Chapter One podcast and I did not know Neil had a fear of clowns. That makes covering It so much worse. So now that we have suspect Welcome to Derry maybe hides the clown, as Andy Muschietti says it, are you looking a little bit more forward to next Sunday night?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to experiencing the lore, but here's the other thing. Andy Muschietti's very good at coming up with just nightmare fuel. So we're still going to get plenty of that. And I imagine that some of the scares in this show are going to be, at the very least, clown adjacent.
So yes.
We're not going to get that far away. And
what really is the difference between Uncle Sam and a clown, if you go down to it?
It's true. Just a little bit of face paint. And I would say that doing this prep, watching the two movies in quick succession like this, has sort of desensitized me to the very specifically Pennywise shtick of it all. Right. Like, I've watched enough behind the scenes of Bill Skarsgård where I'm just like, I'm seeing the performance, not necessarily the character. So that always helps.
Which is good. It is a pretty good physical performance. Whether or not they've overused it already is something that Welcome to Derry is going to need to let us know. Mm-hmm. How confident are they in the season-wise storytelling?
Sure.
Can they do a premiere without the clown?
I was going to say, what do you think are the percentage chances we see him in the first episode?
I'm going to say high, because I do think HBO needs to hook people into this series from the pilot. Mm-hmm. I don't think people will, if you're not a Stephen King fan, if you're not into it, I don't think people are going to stick around for episode two if they don't see at least a glimpse of the clown in episode one.
Yeah.
I hope they pull back after that, but I do think it needs to show up. I would say like
80-90% chance that we see him. Because
good chances.
For the same reasons. Some HBO executive predicated the making of this series on being able to see the clown in the first episode.
Yeah. I think that's why you get Skarsgård back. I also think that is the level of confidence you give to the Muschiettis, who are bouncing back from The Flash, like,
sure,
in terms of a career but perspective. But
only in the eyes of everyone who doesn't work at Warner Brothers. For some reason, everyone inside Warner Brothers still thinks The Flash was a good thing, but
I'm just saying, in terms of fan confidence, I could see an internal meeting being like, we got to have the clown in. Like, we just have to prove that this is the it Muschiettis. This isn't The Flash Muschiettis that are showing up.
Maybe that's the real it. It lives on the Warner Brothers lot and it makes everybody believe that The Flash was a good idea.
Very, very possible. That's going to be it for this week. I think next week we're going to show up for Welcome to Derry, episode one, the pilot. Neil, do you think that's a pun?
I hope so. That would be fun. It's kind of boring.
Mike Hedlund's dad is an Air Force pilot.
I think so.
Like, it's right there.
This here in 2025, I think it's kind of boring to name your pilot the pilot. So I do hope it's got a dual meaning.
All right. Well, we're going to find out next week on the Storm Podcast. Until then, head out there. And don't go near that sewer, little boy. I am an adult stranger, and I know better about this hometown than you do. Thank you.